You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, Alex.
Hey, Nick.
I'm a professor now, bro.
I know. That's exciting at our alma mater, NYU.
NY who?
I remember being there and having, you know, you're an adjunct professor, right?
I am. I'm an adjunct.
Yeah. So what does that mean exactly? Because I have my understanding of what it is, but you tell me.
Well, what's your understanding? You go first. I want to know.
There are people who are brought in per semester to kind of fill gaps in the curriculum. Some of them were actively involved in the industry they were teaching about, and some of them were not. Like, I had an adjunct professor who ended up winning an Oscar for best screenplay the next year. So that was cool. Like, oh, like our professors are winning Oscars. But then I also had a screenwriting professor who's like claim to fame was that he was like a production assistant on The Godfather 3 like 30 years ago.
I mean, so that's awesome. So, no, you're not far off. Adjunct. So I'd say that the defining characteristic of adjuncts is that we are hired semester to semester. We are not capable of getting tenure. I wouldn't call it hired to fill in the gaps. I would say that you are definitely. Well, no. Actually, you know what? That's a fair assessment. Filling in the gaps of the curriculum, the minutiae, like we're there for like maybe things like if you have your core curriculum, we're there for things that are like filling out your curriculum, not filling in. Do you know what I mean? Like we are expanding your curriculum, things that can, you know, be added on.
So is there like a theme to your class?
Contemporary scene analysis.
Contemporary scene analysis. That kind of goes with this podcast a little bit.
It's literally what we do here, except I'm teaching students how to act.
Do you think NYU would ever hire me?
Little Justice, fuck yeah.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Little Justice, this thing that we do. I am Nick Walker.
I'm Alex Smolo.
You are Alex Smolo, apparently singing the theme song.
Like when we're doing this, I put it in after the fact so we don't hear it, but I kind of hear it in my head because I'm like, okay, this is where I'm going to edit it in. And then I start singing it to myself. And then so I'm always just kind of humming it as we come in.
You're like a savant. You're like Russell Crowe in A Beautiful Mind.
Oh, I'm sure it's not in the right key. I'm sure that I'm off in that department, but
it's great. I was more.
It's a catchy tune. We wrote it when we first started trying to do this a long time ago. We were just messing around. I had a guitar or something and we just started messing around as a joke, but like the tune actually kind of stuck. And so when it came time to record the version for this one, it was like, yeah.
Well, and the original one, if you remember, and nobody should remember because the original episodes will never be found.
Please don't remember.
Don't remember. Don't find them. Don't go looking for them. They really aren't episodes that we are proud of. They really could ruin us. Like they could absolutely take us out.
Ain't too proud of those ones, Nick?
God damn you. No, I'm not too proud. Not too proud. I am too proud to beg for those episodes back is what I am. But no, those episodes, like the original theme song was like in a high pitched key. It was like,
little justice.
That was it. Do you know what I mean? And think about that. Think about we were trying to subject people to that every week.
The soothing, like, you know, R&B version that I've come up with, I think is more appealing.
So much more soft and pleasant. It's just supple. Like you're
it's
like
supple.
You know,
it's supple. Eventually, we'll open it up and we'll let audience versions come in. You know, if you want to make your own version of our theme song, we'd be happy to cut it into an episode.
Well, it's like a David Simon show, right? Every season has a different version of the same theme song, and I think we should do that.
Is that how it works?
Oh my god!
Okay, so we just started The Wire.
Wait, have you never seen The Wire?
So I've watched the first season and I never got through to the second season.
Oh my god!
So my wife, one of her coworkers, suggested was like, "It's the greatest show of all time," and like it a little bit.
So we were like,
"Okay, let's watch it." I was always turned off by the original version is like standard definition, square aspect ratio, like very very 90s.
Yes,
which I don't. In and of itself, I don't have a problem with it, but watching three seasons of like a serious drama like that. And I think probably the copy that I'd found, the DVD or whatever, was just like kind of blurry quality. They remastered it recently. I hadn't realized.
It's 1080.
And I went and found it again. And it's widescreen and it's crisp and it looks like it was just shot. And suddenly like all the nuance is coming through. And I'm like, oh, this is why people consider this to be the best show of all time. Gotcha.
It really is a masterpiece. And I actually am watching the companion series right now, which is Treme.
Right.
Same team, but just like, and really same cast, but like just a different setting. You know, The Wire, to get, you know, nerdy on you, The Wire to me is about what happens to the American working class under the American institution.
Right.
It's like the American institution crushing the working class. And Treme, conversely, is about the working class overcoming the institution. And so it's like, it actually is like, when you finish The Wire, I would actually highly suggest just going to
move right on to Treme, especially now in this climate.
Yeah, it will. No, it will. And that's what's actually been really kind of eerie. And it really does speak to this moment, Treme. Like, it really is this moment of like these people who are coming out of this incredible event that like decimated their home and walking out into the rubble and be like, how do we...
Well, it's interesting watching The Wire now in the light of the conversation around police brutality. Because like, obviously, it's always been there. It's always been an issue. Like, the show exists because... And it addresses things that everyone knows about, but it's never been so directly injected into the public consciousness like it has been now. So like watching the nuance of it, like I want to say that The Wire couldn't be doing what it's like, it couldn't be made now with the conversation, but it absolutely could. It's kind of like somebody digested everything that's going on and spit back up like the on the ground things that are happening. Like, here's the reality of it. And like, yes, there's bad, but yes, there's confusion. Yes, there's this. Yes, there's that. Like, it's a very grounded, realistic show that is, you're right. It's surprisingly prevalent.
Well, and it's, and what I love, you know, I think that, and it's something that I really do, you know, I think that sometimes as a writer, I get bogged down in genre and I love high concept, but I think that one of the reasons that I just look up to David Simon as like my favorite writer is someone who, you know, he comes from a journalistic background. So you're watching these series and like, it's not drama in the sense that we understand it today. It's very mundane. Like, these moments in any other TV show would not fly, but it's what he's saying is it's the accumulation of these moments, and he's literally not going to exposit anything. And you have to really just watch these characters over, like, you won't get the payoff for these characters for seasons. Like, it really will go on. And then finally, something that happened in season one will pay off in season four. And you're like, oh my God. You mean like it's like life. And it really follows into Treme as well.
It really is. I mean, it's astounding how little setup there is for, like, it's literally just, this is how things would happen in real life. This is how these characters would act and talk and think and move and make decisions. And it really, it's like slice of life almost. It's a slice of life show. Like, I'm not, you know, you're not sitting there like, oh my God, what's going to happen? I got to watch the next one to figure out. Like, no, you're just watching people do their jobs legally and illegally. Like, that's what you're doing.
Literally. And I, have you, you know what, have you ever read the series Bible for it?
No.
You should read it. I'll send it to you. Yeah? It's just amazing how he describes it. Cause he's like, we're going to focus in on cause when they pitched it, they were saying it's a cop show, but like, everyone thought at the time, okay, this is another NYPD Blue or another homicide or whatever.
Right.
Both of which he had hands in, or definitely had hand in homicide, because that was based on his book, I believe. But he very much was like, look, no, we're actually gonna, you know, focus in on parts of these people's lives that like you wouldn't see on a cop show. And and then the real switch came when, you know, season two, you know, not to ruin it for you, but season two is like a complete pivot. Like, you think you understand the setup by the end of season one, and then season two, you're like, what the hell has happened? Like, it's not like it's a different show, but it's just a different focus. He just opens it up, and
gonna have to finish it.
Yeah, you finish it.
I think. I mean, one of the things I love about it, obviously the character. I mean, maybe the main thing is the characters. Like, that's what the show is the characters. I really love Omar.
Oh yeah, I figured it'd be Omar McNulty for you.
Man, no, McNulty's like he's a little too man child.
Yeah.
But I like Omar because of the duality of it. You know, the show is kind of all about this duality, and he's like this hard ass gangster, not afraid to, you know, take charge, bust into a room blazing, but also he's got this really, you know, soft, tender side that is like, it's kind of shocking against who he is, you know. So I think you could probably call him a heartwarming monster.
I would look at you with your freaking segue.
We're weaving,
we're dodging, we're moving, we're going. And
at least it wasn't a pun. It was a thematic correlation.
It was a great, I would say that you really did a great job with that. And I think that I think that's probably your best one. And I applaud you. You know, Alex is, of course, pointing to today's theme, which is heartwarming. The heartwarming monster movie is how I would phrase it. Because I wouldn't even relegate it to just the monsters themselves being heartwarming. I would say that a movie that has monsters but is also heartwarming is also acceptable.
Yeah, this one was tough because of the number of directions it can go. What kind of movie? Because my mind immediately goes to kids' movies, but then you start thinking about it and like it's inherent in a lot of kids' movies, especially from a certain era. But it's interesting to dig in and find out where the same device is used to tell an adult story too.
I completely agree. And I think that especially when you're dealing with the monster movie, like do you ever find this? What is the last monster movie that like truly terrified you?
That's a good question. That's a really good question. There's a movie, The Ritual, that was really scary, but that wasn't real. There's a monster in it, but you don't really see it till the end and it's not crazy. There's a movie, Troll Hunter, which is very good. I think it's Danish or something like that.
I've heard about that. Norwegian. I haven't watched. I've seen that poster all the time.
I saw it in theaters, not know much about it like 10 years ago. And it's actually very, very, very good. But I feel like the monster, because like you go through this era of monster movies, right? It starts in like, I guess it starts with like Dracula and the Creature from the Black Lagoon and all that in the 20s, 30s. But it evolves into, with the Cold War, it evolves into robots and aliens and zombies and all this stuff. And then you hit the 90s and you get, you know, the 70s, 80s, 90s, you get Alien.
Yeah.
You get slasher movies. You get, you know, monsters like Freddy or Jason, who are kind of human, but not.
Yep.
These kind of dream monsters. So like the concept of a monster, and it's always reflective of what a society is kind of going through, right? Like any horror movie, like it's reflective of our fears. So it's interesting to see people pivot on that and how they can take that fear and use it in a way that enlightens us and makes us feel better about things instead of worse. Mm.
Yeah, it really is a kind of a thing that, you know, if done right, the monsters, and I've always said this, the monsters have to represent something that the hero, so it's symbolism. That's what a monster is. I think that, you know, it really is I don't know, it really is an effective, when you have a good monster movie, it's an effective way of
when was the last time you were really smacked in the face by a monster?
You know, I will say the original, it wasn't the last time, but the original Cloverfield did it for me.
Yeah.
I was pretty scared of that.
Was that due in part to the mystery surrounding that? Because the part of the story of that movie is how it was released and not knowing what it was about.
Yeah.
Did you watch it in that context?
I did watch it in that context. I didn't know what it was about. And I have this weird thing. I am terrified of the idea of getting eaten. That actually terrifies me. Any animal that could like hunt me down and like attack me. Like,
yeah.
There's something there. Like I remember one of my earliest memories, film movie memories, was the live action Jungle Book with Lena Headey and Sam Neill and Jason Scott Lee. Do you remember this?
Carrie
Elwes was in this.
I remember was it made for TV?
No, it was a full out.
It was a full movie. I remember watching it on TV. It was one of those things that made the rotations, and the kid playing it's great. But it was that gritty look. I remember when Shere Khan attacks the tent, the village, and like,
dude,
it's heavy.
It was very, and especially for Disney, I was like, how did y'all think this was okay for children? I watched it back recently, and I was
is that
like,
Disney? I figured it was Disney. Just like they took the Rudyard Kipling source and made their own thing. It was Disney that made it.
It is straight up Disney. It is Disney. It is Michael
Eisner
saying.
And then they never did live action. And then the first live action remake they did of their movies coming back was Jungle Book again to just wash their mouth of it.
Just be like, let's just clean this slate.
Like, the bear can sing again.
It's so true. We're fine. Come on back. Come on back, kids. It's fine.
Come on back. It's all safe here.
Because let me tell you, when I think of a movie that was not safe, it was that Jungle Book.
It was that one. I remember what the knife looked like. Somebody in that movie had a weird bent knife.
The golden knife.
I still remember with the handle. I still remember what
it's in King Louis's treasure trove.
Oh, I want to watch that now.
But like that. Oh, no, it definitely watch it because it was, I think it's in fact directed by like a very famous action director. I'm going to look this up really quickly. Jungle Book 1994 was directed by
67 was the animated one. That's
Stephen Sommers, who directed The Mummy. So of course it was you, Stephen Sommers, you son of a bitch. You coming in scaring these freaking children.
Of course.
Terrifying. Actually terrifying. Like a full out Jungle Book by way of The Mummy.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it was. And I mean, and again, great adventure movie. John Cleese is in there. He's hysterical. But like the entire last 40 minutes of this film is British dudes getting hunted down and eaten by animals.
And eaten. It's amazing.
It's
amazing.
I can't
believe. So that's not heartwarming. So that's, nor that's are there not, monsters. I don't really know how we got off on this today.
Well, no.
Because you're getting eaten by monsters.
I would, it's eaten. Eaten, any movie where people are getting eaten or assaulted, like it's, you know what it is? It's the shot of, it's the now cliche shot where the animal attacks, you know, jumps on him or whatever. You don't see it. And then you just see their legs twitching from behind like a thing where while this animal like picks apart their fucking flesh. I can't do that. That actually does make me upset. And like, there were so many.
Have you ever seen Anaconda?
I mean, we need to have a whole episode on Anaconda.
On Anaconda and Lake Placid. Both of those movies together. Double feature. If I ran a drive-in theater, the first thing I would do is run a double feature of Anaconda and Lake Placid.
Yeah. I think that we need to do that. I think that we need to need to go for it and have an Anaconda Lake Placid double. a grindhouse.
Let's do it.
Oh my god, no, we're gonna do it, guys. You've heard it here first. We're having an Anaconda Lake Placid grindhouse feature, like to the death, duel to the death for which is the best crappy ass,
the best worst giant animal coming
giant
to
animal
you
coming
movie.
To eat you film. Oh my god.
So none of this is heartwarming at all.
No, at all, at all, at all.
So if monsters represent the worst of us, right? Does a good monster movie have to have a message of we are the real monsters?
No, I don't think so. I think that it has to have a message. I think that my favorite monster movies are the monster movies that warm my heart, I should say, are the movies where you watch them. And after a while, and like, you know, it's a trial. They've survived something. They have gotten through something that they shouldn't have gotten through. And even if we're talking like a monster movie where the monster is heartwarming, right? Like the Iron Giant is the first thing that comes to mind, where it's this giant titanium robot monster that, you know, and it's like, I think there's, you know, there's always been this trope of like, you know, of these monsters that like, you know, befriend the young child and, you know, and then we go on an adventure with them and we cry when they die and all that stuff. It's, I mean, it's, you know, it's Old Yeller. I mean, it's literally that paradigm. I think that even in those cases, it's understanding that, you know, you've survived this and maybe the world's going to be a little bit brighter. Maybe you have an understanding that you didn't have before. Mm-hmm. You've survived this ordeal and come through with.
So instead of the monster coming to kill you, the monster comes and teaches you a lesson.
The monster in trying to kill you.
Is that what makes something heartwarming? Like when something is heartwarming, the lesson that's heartwarming? Is it the characters? Is something good happening to the characters that's heartwarming? Like, what is that feeling that you get?
I think it's the character's growth. I think it's
a growth thing.
It's something, you know, and going back to conversation about Treme, so many of the moments that are heartwarming, because, you know, like Treme is full of heartwarming moments. You know, I think so many of the moments that are heartwarming are when you see characters who have struggled with something. That moment where they finally get it, or that moment where somebody helps them, that moment where in the midst of craziness,
it is
okay. Like, and I think that's why a monster movie, so many monster movies can have that heartwarming vibe, because, you know, so often chaos follows in a monster movie, whether it's like, you know, lovely chaos or serious chaos, but like those moments where it's like, oh God, we've made it. we've made it out. Like that breath afterwards, I think is so important.
I'm wondering because when you first brought up this idea to do this episode, my thought was like, okay, like monsters that by like we like them, right? Like
yep.
Monsters that are monsters, but they're attractive to us, like the Disney monsters. Are there examples, do you think, of movies where the monster stays a monster, but it is heartwarming in what in the surrounding, you know, confusion of the monster's existence?
Oh, I think so. In fact, the movie that I've chosen,
does that.
I think so. I think it does it. Now, I will say, heartwarming. You know, I think that what I find heartwarming, it, like I said, is characters finding their strength. Characters who like it's a very delicate balance because. It's so hard because I have two movies that kind of work for this, and I watched them both, and I'm going back and forth. There's one that's a more obvious choice,
yeah,
and there's one that's like a less obvious choice, but to me is heartwarming.
Yeah,
honestly, it didn't intend to be. I think I'm going to go with that one. Honestly, I'm going to go with that one.
So before we dive in, I want to start with yours, because I was running around the same way of like, wow, maybe this one, but then this one does this well and this one doesn't. I realized that there are three directors, whatever you picked is probably falls into one of these categories, that do this the best, right? Everything comes back to they all do it in different ways. It's all presented differently in terms of how they create their characters and their monsters, you know, the lessons learned, the inherent themes, the stories, the whatever. The visuals, it's Spielberg does it really, really well. Obviously,
yes, right? He's his the king
whole
of this.
Thing is the king of this.
Yes.
And like Jurassic Park is one of those movies that like, you know, the monsters are still monsters throughout the whole thing, but they help the characters grow anyway. Guillermo del Toro.
Absolutely.
All of his movies, you know, Shape of Water is pretty obvious, even especially given
but
the recent
he always
stuff,
brings
but like,
that some heart. Like,
but
even
it's
Hellboy.
Yeah, all of his stuff, because his whole thing is monsters, right? He had, you know, as a kid, he saw things and you know, he's just one of those guys that lives in the world of fantasy creatures.
Yeah.
But has a heart, and like Pan's Labyrinth is a great example of, you know, lessons learned by dealing with monsters. And Miyazaki.
Yes.
You know, Miyazaki, the anime director. So like Spirited Away, Princess Mononoke, where... the whole movie is creatures and monsters and the unknown in the spirit world, but a very human story threading through it.
Yes.
So those three, I couldn't think of, and my choice is not one of those, but I couldn't think of any movie that I would have picked that is not in the gravity of those three directors.
It is definitely, the movie that I picked is certainly a movie that
wouldn't exist without those guys.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, man.
All right, well, line it up.
Okay. We open on a dark night sky. All of a sudden, eerie music has been playing the entire time, kind of intense music. A blue, blazing light is soaring through this dark night sky. Then we're getting, you know, we're kind of following this blue light, and it kind of disappears on us, but we follow it enough to pan down to what's below it, which is London. Streets in London. seeing a young white woman walking through these streets, talking on the phone, walking past graffiti. She's in the neighborhood that maybe she kind of finds a little uncomfortable. Surroundings that maybe aren't hers. She's talking to a friend. All of a sudden, she turns behind her. Three figures in the night, standing on the street behind her. Turns around, a young boy in front of her, wearing a hoodie and a bandana around his face.
Give me the phone, give me the phone, give me the phone!
He starts speaking in like this very, like straight up, just like British, like, but like not even British, like, I wouldn't even call it Cockney. It's like a specific accent, like a specific South London accent. And they mug this woman right when they're in the middle of mugging her. The same meteorite that we saw at the beginning falls from the sky, crashes into a car. The woman runs away. The boys go in to inspect it. Small alien pops out, scratches the leader's face, runs off into a field. The boys are terrified, but they're also badasses, and they chase it. And this is a good decision. There
oh,
you go.
Sorry. Yeah.
No. You're right.
Attack the block.
Attack the block, baby.
I'm gonna see.
You know what that is? I'll tell you what that is. That's an alien, bruv. Believe it. Must have come from outer space trying to take over the Earth, innit? When I landed in the wrong place, though, you get the wrong place.
Welcome to London, motherfucker.
Welcome to the end, brother.
This is the block, fam. Nobody fucks with the block. Do you get me? The B-L-O-C-K.
Attack the block. The block. Good choice.
Bro. It was, can I tell you, it was between this and Jurassic Park. It was absolutely between this and Jurassic
Park.
I'm sure
that it was. I figured you were going to bring one of the, I thought you were going to bring Jurassic Park or E.T. to the table.
E.T. I'm saving those first for a
better. I know you are. The day you use Jurassic Park, that's going to be your peak.
That's it. Like then the podcast has nowhere to go after that. But
so Attack the Block is John Boyega's kind of star turn, right?
I think it's his first film. I think this was
his very first one.
His first time out. Yeah, it was written and directed by Joe Cornish, who actually has not done much else. He did that King Arthur kids reboot a couple years back. But he wrote Ant-Man, you know, which was like a project that I guess he was originally going to do with Edgar Wright. So he has a writing credit on Ant-Man. Yeah, it's so funny. I mean, it's very strange to me because I love this movie and I would have loved to see more from this guy. And I hope that he picks up making movies again. So Attack the Block, I think the brilliance of Attack the Block is that it really is a metaphor. It's a giant metaphor. And it's a metaphor that like when I saw it, I was like, it was just the first time that I'd seen somebody even attempt to do something like this. And it really made me, you know, it's so funny that we're speaking about The Wire. Cause I mean, that's essentially
right. With The Wire, with aliens.
And what it really is a commentary on is like the trauma of black urban youth in South London and what they're going through, why they choose to be in a gang. The world is terrifying around them and that this world that already hates them and hunts them down and kills them is personified by these vicious aliens that come from the sky. And like what's really powerful about this movie is that they pull no punches. I mean, most of these kids die. You know what I mean? Like truly.
That's why it's interesting because like heartwarming is not the first word that comes to mind when I think of this movie. But as I think more about it and the underlying sentiment of it, it is. It's hopeful. It's a hopeful movie.
It's a hopeful movie. And what I think that the reason where I find the heartwarming in it is Moses, is John Boyega's character. So John Boyega, I mean, really, I think is still to this day his best performance. I think he's brilliant in this film. And it's startling because he was a teenager when he made this and he just struck. It's very much on par with like, what's her name? Millie Bobby Brown from Stranger Things, where a child actor just comes out and it's like, who the hell are you?
Yeah.
And he
that she wishes she'd get handed a Star Wars contract.
Dude, well, no, but she's pleased. She's fine. She's got so many friends.
Yeah, the so new the Sherlock Holmes show coming out. Oh my God. Looks trailer's great.
She's gonna
looks
be killer. Good. Killer. Yeah. But I think with John Boyega, it was just like he doesn't even have that many lines. Like he literally is the silent kind of like stoic leader of these kids. So all of the stuff that he's doing is through his eyes and through his actions. And, you know, it really is like just this kind of movie where you're following him and you just get glimpses of like his life.
Who do you live with?
Just my uncle.
Where's he?
Comes and goes. Goes mostly.
The reason I find it heartwarming is because you realize very quickly that you're just watching these black kids survive life. Like mm-hmm. that's what, like he has this line that I wrote it down that I want to read. And it's like, you know, they're talking about where the aliens come from. And he goes, I reckon the feds sent them anyway. Government probably bred those things to kill black boys. First they sent in drugs, then they sent guns, and now they're sending monsters in to kill us. They don't care, man. We ain't killing each other fast enough. So they decided to speed up the process. Like,
I love that.
That's, you know what I mean? Like that's,
yeah.
And that line shows not only like, you know, social commentary in terms of the larger picture of the movie, but also like the trauma of this, of the worthlessness this kid feels.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like you really are watching a young man find his power and belief in himself.
And that's really what he does. I mean, it really is about these kids taking control
yes.
of a situation that yes. is uncontrollable. Yes. Watching them tame it over the course of the movie is like, you know, regardless of whether they're, you know, inner city kids in London or they could be anywhere, which is kind of the flavor of a movie like E.T.
Yeah.
Where it's like the kids rise up and save the day when the adults can't do it because, but in like an aggressive R-rated, you know, action-y way.
Yeah. And it really, you know, the knowing once you, I mean, and especially because of how it's not like I think the other thing about an action movie where you kill kids is, you know, when you have this movie, if this movie was any of these movies that where aliens are attacking a group of people, the adults generally don't have time to take it personally. Do you know what I mean? Right. Like they're just trying to solve this thing. But every death that happens in this movie is taken so, it hits them so hard. And like, it's just, I mean, you just allowing for the time to process that, like,
yeah,
these are kids.
I mean, it's a great setup because like these are kids and all they have is each other. Like it's tragic enough that these kids can't rely on adults, right? They live in this universe where all they have is each other for support.
Yeah.
They have. And to watch somebody in that situation get plucked away from you by a monster, which is something that youths and communities like that have to deal with. You know, something the Wire is really good about showing you is like how close these relationships become
yeah.
and how quickly lives get snuffed out, how kind of disposable they become.
Yeah. And what that does to your psyche.
And what that does. Like yeah. how you start seeing human life when you know that could happen at any point where it's like more likely than not to happen.
And it's yeah, it's so deep and it works on so many levels. And the most heartwarming moment is truly at the end, you know, John Boyega's character never smiles in this movie, never really? Smiles.
It's been a long time since I've seen it.
Oh my God, go back and watch. It's so good. Yep. He really is just like stone-faced. And the first time he really smiles is at the end of this film. Once he's defeated them and the block starts cheering for him and it's just like this moment of like, we did it. Like, A, we did it. A, we defeated these monsters, but B, like, we're going to be okay. And it really is. This is like the, I just love it. And I also love that the, you know, Jodie Whittaker's character who ends up allying with them. Right. And that I think is such a wonderful thing is on Joe Cornish's part is that he chose to, in this story that's largely about race and class, he chose to have, you know, these young adults pair with these kids and kind of be led by these kids, these people who would all be scared of these kids if they met them on the street.
That's part of the empowerment, you know, these people you glance over that you don't give a second thought that you think, you know, are unsavable are the ones
who are going to save you.
If you just give them the opportunity.
My God. It's, I love this movie so much.
That's great.
Yeah.
You got a little brother?
No.
How old are you?
15.
You look older.
Thanks.
That's a great choice. That's a really great choice. It reminds me a little bit of District 9.
Which oh my
I didn't
God!
Think about either. I think Attack the Block is a little sharper in terms of its commentary. You know, District 9 is a little obvious.
Yeah, District 9 is very. It's very.
It's well made.
Well, I mean, no, I love because is that Neil Blomkamp?
Blomkamp.
Yeah, I love District 9, and I wasn't. You know, none of his follow ups quite hit me.
It hasn't. You know, I like Chappie. I think Chappie.
I heard Chappie.
I wouldn't say it's
good.
Underrated, yeah. But it's fun.
Yeah,
and watching the members of Die Antwoord try to act is interesting. They're interesting characters. I like what Neil Blomkamp tries to do, but you're right. Elysium and Chappie and all of his movies haven't really hit the same mark as District 9.
I do love that he maintained. I always have respect for directors who maintain an aesthetic like him.
Yeah. He knows what he's about.
He knows what he is. And I feel like Ridley Scott does that as well. Like all of his movies have a very specific quality. And
that's an interesting example.
Oh my God. Ridley Scott?
you think so?
Dude, I think all of his, especially, go ahead.
Even with his history of taking what he was from 20, 30 years ago and trying to like reboot it into something completely different from what it was.
I think that watching, at least design wise, at least, you know, in terms of the aesthetics of his shots and what he, you throw a movie in front of me, I can tell you if it's a Ridley Scott film. I can tell you.
Interesting.
In 10 seconds, I can tell you. Like I just feel like he has a way.
I guess I look at him in the same vein as I do Francis Ford Coppola, where like the hunger of youth is what drove.
Yes.
And I mean, to be fair, Ridley Scott didn't start making movies until he was in his 40s.
Yeah.
And this was Alien back in the 70s. He's still alive, still making stuff. Like he started old, but you know, the fire of youth, so to speak, you know, brought out the risk taking and working within constraints and all this stuff. And I feel like as they were given, you know, grander careers and allowed to do what they wanted and take their time and all that, it didn't, you know, it hasn't really come out with anything breathtakingly exciting.
No, I agree with that. But you know, hey man, so was Gladiator. You know what I mean?
Gladiator. So, man, I fucking love Gladiator.
Yo, yeah. Sarah hates Gladiator. Straight up.
Why?
I talked to her about it. We tried watching it at a, you know, I will agree, like watching it back.
It doesn't treat the women characters very well. It doesn't really have, you know, they're there to be, you know.
They are. But beyond that, I would even say like watching it back, like, when I watched it in eighth grade, I thought it was like I thought it was like Christopher Nolan level, like smart. It is not a smart film. It is like pure
testosterone.
It's like balls. Like it's literally just like Joaquin Phoenix and Russell Crowe waving their balls in your face for like 2.5 hours.
It really is.
Oh my God. I didn't realize that.
And this
is
kind of like
back.
Before I knew how crazy Joaquin Phoenix really was. God.
Dude, that Going scene where he kills his dad, it's like,
yeah,
and he's like snotting all over poor
monster, dude.
Dude, you're out of control. Please stop subjecting your co-stars to your goddamn saliva. What's wrong with
Jesus.
You?
Jesus.
Out of control, man.
Jeez.
So yeah, so talk to me. So my choice.
Good choice.
Thanks,
well, you're
buddy.
Gonna laugh. You're gonna laugh at my choice.
I'm very excited.
Well, because we've already
discussed it.
We've already discussed it. So we open. The kind of the same way as yours.
Yep.
On space.
Good for you.
A satellite comes by.
Yep.
Sputnik.
Sputnik.
Something that flies by.
What an era.
The old Russian satellite. So, you know, the 50s.
Yeah.
Crashes into the ocean. There's a storm raging. A boat's on the waves crashing back and forth. An old man radioing, looking for help. Can't find the lighthouse. He can't see it.
Where is he?
He doesn't know how he's going to get back. He turns around. There's a bright light standing above the water.
Uh-oh.
Into the radio. I see the lighthouse. I'm saved. The light turns towards him. It's two eyes. He's not saved. His boat crashes into something big. He's thrown into the water, washes up on shore, looks up. It's the lighthouse. Cut to the title. The Iron Giant.
Thrust her to base. I'm going in. Only one creature could create so much destruction. The hideous, people-eating, killing machine, Atomo! Atomo!
No, Atomo. I, Superman.
Okay, Superman.
The Iron Giant. So I went back and forth like with a lot of options. Like I wanted to do Spirited Away, but I think that was too, it's not monstery enough. And there's one other one I wanted to do, if I remember.
Well, can I tell you my personal connection to the Iron Giant?
No, I know. So this annoys the shit out of me. So yeah. I went researching it after I watched it this morning. And like most things, you're connected to it because originally it was brought to the stage. It was from a story, but it was brought to the stage by Des Makanoff.
Yep.
I was like, oh, great. So yep. Nick knows all about the Iron Giant.
I know. All
That's fantastic. I'm so excited to talk to him about that.
Yeah.
Have you talked to Des about that?
I've definitely asked. So like, because you have to understand, you know, when I did, Des Makanoff, Broadway director, also film director, directed Rocky and Bullwinkle. If you didn't know.
Until I looked at his Wikipedia this morning, I had no idea just how prolific he was.
Yeah, he's done a lot of things.
Yeah, he's serious.
He's out of control. But this particular film was a childhood favorite of mine and was also, you know, you could clearly see the roots of Yoshimi in what he was trying to do with this. I would have loved to see the Pete Townsend version that he was trying to make, because I think he was originally trying to make this a stage play with Pete Townsend.
So it was based on a story from the 50s that somebody had written. Sylvia Plath's husband had written this story to help their kids after she committed suicide.
Oof, wow.
He wrote it as like a coping mechanism.
Wow.
Pete Townsend found it in the 70s, and him and Des, I guess, after the success of Tommy, they wanted to find a new thing to bring to the stage, and this is what they looked at. Never happened, and then come the 90s, and it was directed by Brad Bird, you know, who's going on to do all the
amazing stuff.
All the amazing stuff. It fell into his lap. And it translated, you know, and it's one of those movies where like usually the animation system is very, it's run from the top down, right? Like there's not a whole lot of creative control because every decision you make is, you know, on site in an edit room where executives can come find you and look at what you're doing and change things. You know, there's not. So usually animation is very, very, and Pixar and Disney do this, like there is not one frame of a Disney or Pixar movie that is not poured over by executives and decided on. You know, I've talked to people who have written Pixar movies, and they go through like 20 writers on these things, and the end script is something that's so poured over. With the Iron Giant, what happened was they were just trying to recover from Quest for Camelot.
Wow.
They just needed an animation to bounce back from that. And they were focused on a bunch of other stuff. And they basically said, like, you know, we're going to give you a third of the budget you'd normally have, but we don't really care what you do. Just give us something good. So like the animation team basically just spent all day, you know, going over storyboards and coming up with ideas. And like they had full creative control. They did it like half the time, a third of the budget, and came out with a movie. It's got a renown for the quality of it.
Jesus.
It really holds up to this day. So
I love it.
So I mean, from a monster standpoint, you know, it's a little obvious, and I was trying to find something. I think your choice was a lot more, you know,
no, but this is a
subtle, intricate dynamic than mine, but I think a heartwarming monster movie, you know, is inherent to a childhood experience, right?
Inherent.
Because it's about taking a fear.
Yeah.
And kids are so easily afraid, as are adults.
Yeah.
And working to understand, seeing behind the curtain that it's not what you think it is. It's not the scary thing you think it is. And actually, you can connect with things that you're afraid of. You know, you can grow from things that you're afraid of. And I think that it comes into so many different kids' movies.
No, absolutely.
I think that this one especially, because the whole message at the end of the day is about, you know, it's existential. It's about what does it mean to be you, to be your authentic self, to be kind, to be inquisitive, to be, you know, to not take things lying down. It's got an aggression to it that I think other films like this don't have, that E.T. doesn't have. It's like, once the army comes for the robot fights back. Yep. You know, like it yep. comes back hard. And it's a very sharp, quick display.
Where's the giant?
You can't protect him, Hogarth, any more than you can protect your mother.
My mom?
It's difficult to raise a boy all alone. We could make it more difficult. In fact, we could make it so difficult that it would be irresponsible for us to leave you in her care. And all that implies. You'll be taken away from her, Hogarth.
You can't do that!
Oh, we can. And we will.
Can we talk about Superman?
We can talk about Superman.
The Superman moment?
Where he's flying at the missile?
Yep.
So the climax of the film, the army guys ordered a missile strike and called it in prematurely. It's going to hit the town. And they build Superman into the story. You know, he's got the Action Comic number one, but it's back when it just came out, so it's not an important thing. He's just explaining to the giant, the kids explain to this giant, you know, Superman, basically, this super strong giant thing, what the point of Superman is. And he sort of, you know, the innocence of the kid teaches him to be good. You know, it teaches the monster, teaches the robot to be good. And it climaxes in him flying up into space in that normal, you know, the Dark Knight Rises kind of way, where he's like, I'm going to go blow up in the atmosphere to save everybody.
Yep.
And it's heartwarming.
It really
is. Very heartwarming. Well,
he hears Hogarth is asking him, you know,
bad to kill, guns kill, and you don't have to be a gun. You are what you choose to be. You choose. Choose.
Hogarth. You can be who you want to be, or you are. And he, you know, he thinks to himself, he's like Superman. And I will say, this is absolutely, if you're watching this movie, you're gonna cry. So at some point you will have, it's one of those movies that's just so well made and so just so emotional. Like, because it really is this very E.T. beautiful friendship. And I think that also I will posit, without the Iron Giant, we would not have Iron Groot. There's no way.
No. I was going to say, Vin Diesel plays the Iron Giant. And I thought, like, this is the start of his career, you know, doing minimal dialogue, grunting characters. But he does it really well. And, like, I think it really plays to, like, understanding who Vin Diesel is. Because, you know, in the Fast and Furious movies, he comes off as this gruff, you know, tough guy, testosterone, whatever. But he chooses some of these roles like this that take the big man, take these strong, big characters and make them inherently vulnerable just by the nature of the sounds that they make. And it's impressive. And the fact that he's done it twice makes me think it's not a coincidence.
No, I don't think it is. And I think that, I mean, I think back to even like his first, you know, the first time I saw him was Saving Private Ryan, where he's real. I mean, he really plays a great character in that movie. And you know, you think about his trajectory and like now we know Vin Diesel as like, as you know, Dominic Toretto. We got to do Fast and the Furious movies. We got to do like the best Fast and Furious movie.
I'd have to watch all of them.
Oh, no. We have to watch all of them. Should do that anyway.
Do you know what I mean? This is masochistic at this point. No, yeah, let's do an episode where we watch nine
Fast and the Furious
movies straight
and choose our favorites. Dude, I think that's another great. I'm just saying, we got topics, baby.
we got topics, baby.
But no, it really is. You forget that he like is a very, because we know him for one big character. You forget that like he's an actor. Like he really knows, and especially like he's a great voice actor. I mean, I'm sure he's also had some great voice directors. But like he really gets you in the friggin' heartstrings. He gets you right in the feels. But yeah, man, Iron Giant, great choice. Also love that we're getting an animated film in here.
That's the thing is like, you know, we always choose these kind of like dark, intricate movies, you know, with all this subtext and all these winding things and, you know, cinema, whatever.
Sometimes
it's nice. It was really nice. I got up early this morning, made some coffee, sat down and watched The Iron Giant. And I enjoyed every second of it. I wasn't looking at my phone. You know, I'm just like in it and it felt good at the end. My heart's warmed.
I love that.
It's, yeah, I feel good about it.
You are who you choose to be.
Superman.
So, the Block and Iron Giant.
Attack the Block and the Iron Giant. Let us know what you think.
Yeah, as always, please hit us up on our social media at Lil Justice Pod on Twitter, @LiljusTice Pod. And that's also on Instagram as well. Hit us
it
up.
It is.
Let us know what your pick for movie would be. Alex, I think we've done a good job here today. I think
I think we have. I like these ones. They're just, you know, they're interesting conversation. You know, it's nice to catch up with my friend.
And I didn't
see what movies he's been watching.
I only sweared twice. I only swore twice.
You only swore twice. You're really watching that now.
Yeah. Really, I'm super watching that.
Paying attention. Especially, that's great.
Especially because I'm about to start teaching class.
So, yeah.
You know,
gonna have to be careful of a lot of stuff now. A
lot of things. A lot of things about my personality that cannot fit at NYU.
Oh my goodness.
It's terrible.
That's terrifying. That's terrifying.
Oh yeah, I don't like it either. But you know what? Yeah. They hired me. Ladies and gentlemen, yep, get a skid at us at the social medias, and otherwise we will see you soon.
Bye everybody.
Bye.
Little Justice. Little Justice. Little Justice. Fuck yeah.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.